On a Thursday, you're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about safety net programs and new research and how people feel about having to make a payment to receive a specific welfare benefit. So like a co-payment at a doctor's office or pay a dollar to receive food stamps. This research looks at how Americans feel about whether people living in poverty should have to chip in or do work in exchange for aid. Do you depend on social programs right now? Is it through your local or state government, perhaps a church or charity? What qualifications are you required to meet to receive benefits? Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Anya Somick is an economics professor at the University of Southern California. Her study examines how Americans feel about taxpayer contributions and requirements for welfare benefits. Anya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, nice to be here.
So you're a behavioral economist. What did you set out to learn when you put this project together?
Well, there's a big debate in behavioral economics about how recipients of aid are using that aid and when it comes to contribution requirements. But we were really interested in understanding how the American people feel more generally about whether these requirements should be part of aid programs. And that hadn't been something people had looked at. So we used a large representative panel of Americans that's hosted here at the University of Southern California, and we asked them a few questions about that.
Yeah, so before we get to find out how they felt, how was the study conducted, and what were you able to gather from participants as you asked some of these questions?
So what we were really interested in doing is putting people in the shoe of the policymaker and trying to see whether they would contribute toward a program in which recipient contribution requirements were or were not required. And so we put people into different groups, and different groups received different messages about what type of food aid program we were providing. And it was a program that we actually then implement here in Los Angeles. And in some of the groups, we told them that this healthy food aid program is valued at $10, but people can receive it for free. And in other groups, we said it's the same program, but this time the recipients must contribute a dollar or about 10% of the cost of the program. And we had another treatment or another group that said it's a $5 contribution relative to $10. And we did something similar for time contribution. So we said either this program takes no time at all. You just come in to the grocery store, you pick up your free bag of healthy food groceries, or you must wait 5 minutes to do a registration process, or you must wait 25 minutes to do a registration process. And what we were trying to see is whether people recognize the trade-off that economists recognize about these food aid programs or aid programs in general, which is that it's very hard when you offer a program for free to target those who most value the program. So anyone might come up and take the food aid and maybe not value it or not use it. On the other hand, if you make a contribution requirement, like it must cost a dollar, fewer people will take it up, so more people who value it will take it up, but you might be screening out those people who really need it. So there will be people who can't afford it or who can't spend the time.
And screening out is certainly a concern, because then suddenly you are not meeting the whole mission of the aid program itself.
Exactly.
So what did you find from the people who were going through this process? What did they feel and what did they support?
So we actually find something that's well in line with what economists would expect would happen, which was that people recognize that trade-off. And so we had the most support for the program in which there was a little bit of contribution requirement, but we had the least support for programs in which people had to contribute a lot. So in a follow-up survey, we see that for this 25-minute registration process program, only 8% of people say they like it. Only 12% of people like this $5 cost program, but about a third preferred a free program, and a third each preferred a $1 cost or 5-minute registration program. So people recognize that these programs that have a small contribution requirement do help us identify those who are most in need. They also recognize that higher contribution requirements are a problem because they crowd out the ability of those people most in need to have access to those programs.
You know, when I was, reading and looking at your study, it just reminded me so much of the work of Habitat for Humanity, which has a long tradition, a long history of involving the family who will live in that home, that they have to help build that home. And that's certainly the whole, ethic that Habitat has really worked to push forward through the years. I'm wondering, does it matter how large the benefit is or how substantial a change it will make on a particular person or family as they move forward in life?
So certainly Habitat for Humanity is one program that we also thought about as we were doing this. And I think our thought of doing this study was to really understand how those programs survive and why we have programs like Habitat for Humanity that require aid, but we have other programs that also provide housing that don't require contribution requirements. And we see that there's some Americans who support one and some who support the other, and they showed that through their donations as well in the study. So this study can tell us why we do see those different types of charities out there because there's support for those. I think in terms of your second question about the level of aid, that's not something we looked at in the study, but I imagine that's definitely important, that if you're thinking about something that is of a higher value, then perhaps the entire scale gets shifted a little bit. But that's not something that we looked at, and it's also unclear what we might find.
Talking with University of Southern California economics professor Anya Samick. Let's go to the phones now with David in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Hi, David.
Good morning. This is a really great topic. I just wanted to say that I am disabled and I do rely on several sources of aid. That's anecdote, but that's what I argue. And I wanted to say that with regard to any charge one makes for a charitable a handout, that disproportionately affects women and people of color because they make less statistically than anyone else. So that any charge you make is inherently racist and misogynistic. And I have fibromyalgia, which led to obesity, and it's very hard for me to move around or do anything. And if I, in the foods that I want to eat or that I need to eat, that shouldn't be dictated, or the things I need shouldn't cost anything. I should get it. I shouldn't have to pay anything for them. And I should be able to eat what I want. And I'll take your response off.
Thank you, David. And Anya, we're coming here up on a break, but he's saying disproportionately affecting women and people of color.
So what I didn't talk about earlier is that there is also a lot of research on how this affects recipients. And I think it's right that even very small contribution requirements have been shown to cause big issues in people accessing programs like Medicaid and so on. And I think that's an important point to consider.
Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you used welfare benefits in the past? What was that experience like? Were there requirements you had to meet? Were there programs with qualifications that were out of reach for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Anya Samick stays with us from the University of Southern California, where she is an economist. We'll be back with this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the question is, should low-income people do something or pay something to get benefits from an assistance program like, say, a food pantry? And that was the underlying question, one of them, in a study that looked at so-called contribution requirements. Turns out Americans don't agree on how safety net programs should work, how they should dispense their aid. Do you currently depend on social programs? Is it through local or state government, perhaps a church or a charity? What qualifications do you have to meet? Be part of this discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. University of Southern California economics professor Anya Samick stays with us, and her study is in the Journal of Public Economics. Anya, many policymakers around the country are adjusting or implementing requirements for SNAP benefits, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. What would you suggest lawmakers take from your research and really talk about as they look at requirements around SNAP?
I think it's really important to consider the views of the American public when making those types of decisions. And the biggest takeaway from my research, I would say, is that programs that people feel impose a too great of a cost on recipients are not programs that Americans tend to value. And the debate in our study seems to be between offering a program for free or imposing a very nominal cost. In our case, it was a dollar. On the other hand, this is from other research in economics showing that even very small requirements do make it very difficult for people who most need the aid that don't have the funds to pay those requirements to receive them. So I think there's both sides of the issue. There's what do Americans support, and also how does this affect recipients?
When we look inward here in Wisconsin, Wisconsin lawmakers voted last December to implement work requirements for able-bodied childless adults under 50 who are insured through the state's Medicaid program. What does the research show about occupation-related requirements for welfare?
So in our study, it seemed like there was more opposition to requirements that were monetary than to requirements that were work-based. And I think that's because of this idea that people who are most in need have a more difficult time meeting monetary requirements than they do meeting time requirements or work requirements.
So this research has shown that a small requirement will ensure the recipient is more likely to use a benefit. And we're talking about this fine line between that. A lot of the research on the recipient side of this welfare equation comes from developing countries. Why is that?
Right. So in developing countries, we spend a lot of time thinking about how to distribute aid, and there's aid is distributed widely in the form of mosquito nets or anti-diarrhea tablets. And their researchers have done large-scale field studies in which they go out and some groups receive these for free and some groups have to pay a nominal cost. And there the research seems to be concluding that offering the programs for free is probably better because the cost of excluding people who can't afford it is much larger than the cost of including some people who might receive it and not use it or not value it.
In your research, you studied food aid. Do you know how Americans feel when the safety net program is related to health care? Do we have any research out there?
I don't think so. So in our case, this was just a first study trying to look at surveying people about this question with respect to food aid, just because I think it's easier to ask people a question about a specific topic, and this is the one we chose. So future work should definitely look at those types of questions.
And can you infer here, can you extrapolate this information you learned about charitable giving and welfare benefits, how people might feel about the amount of tax dollars they'd be willing to contribute to a social program?
Well, in our study, we had people contribute some of the money that they earned as part of participating in the survey, and we saw a large proportion of people contributing. So people contributed about a third of their earnings from the survey. I think that's very different from what you could think about for taxes, but it does show that people are interested in helping those who are less advantaged to receive aid.
And when an organization, a charity, a local government, state government would put a work requirement or a particular dollar amount, a $1 for a food pantry, does that add up? Does that impact them economically in terms of the organization itself? Does the organization need that aid in order to do what it does?
I think in the case of these very small contribution requirements, I suspect that they add more to the administrative cost of running the program than they might actually help with the cost of running the program.
And do you know why is that?
So that is my speculation. I think it's just if you're going to start collecting a dollar from everyone, and then you need someone to keep track of who's paid a dollar and who hasn't, and then you need someone to take all that money and put it away and have an accountant to manage it, I just feel like these very small requirements seem like they're more to appease people who might think that those requirements are necessary than they might actually be toward helping out. And that's the some of the types of requirements that have been instituted as well is people talk about time requirements from the perspective of we want to have a registration process for a program that's relatively long to try to help target just those people who really need it, who are willing to go through that process. And in those cases, we call that a dead weight loss, essentially in econ terms, something that's not useful at all. So I think I would be doubtful that these requirements help in a significant way toward the operating costs, especially when they're very low. And the very low requirements are the ones that I think are most supported in our study.
Let's go to Marie in Edgerton. Hi, Marie.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can, yes. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll take my question off air. I noticed that the biggest pushback are the people that have not had a catastrophic event in their life or their family. And so until they understand that the people that are going through these social, economic, or having to go and request assistance because they're not being able to either feed their family or somebody lost their job or somebody like disability, how do you educate these people with empathy that, you know, they may not, the people that are giving their tax money may not have the ability to have that empathy to understand that maybe somebody was having a good economic status and things were going great until something catastrophic happened and now they're having to go and ask for help. I'll take my...
Marie, thank you so much for the call and the psychological impact there and the empathy impact. Anya?
I think that's a very important point, that there is an empathy component to deciding how you would like aid distributed. And my hope in humanity is that we do have a lot of empathy. One aspect of the study that I didn't mention earlier is in the charity contribution part of the study, where we had people choose whether to contribute to the program that cost a dollar or $5, we then also asked people, after we see someone's willing to pay a dollar, would you be willing to refund them? So it's this idea that I'm showing that I can pay a dollar because I really do value this product, but really I can't afford it. And we saw that 80% of our respondents were willing to refund the money to the recipient. So the idea is that some of the reason why people support these dollar or very small contribution requirement programs is they just really have a hard time figuring out who they think would value the aid. But once they see someone has shown that they're willing to contribute, then they're willing to refund. So that's a highlight or positive aspect of our study when it comes to this question of empathy.
Anya, where does research like this go from here? What are you looking at next?
Well, I think the next question really is one that you brought up earlier, which is to try to understand how this scales. So trying to see what people feel about programs that are more consequential, like Medicaid, and looking to see how people feel about programs that are more that are different from food aid. So that would be a way to validate the results of this study and to perhaps better understand the nuances of perceptions of these types of programs.
Anya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anya Samick is a professor of economics at the University of Southern California. Up next, it's news. Then we'll learn what makes an award-winning button collection. What questions do you have about collecting buttons? Are you a collector yourself? How did you get started? And what kind of buttons are your favorites? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll meet up with the Wisconsin State Button Society after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about button collections and button collectors here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. Did your mother or grandmother have a button jar or a button box? My mom's was in a large mason jar filled to the brim with buttons of all sizes and types. And so I'd spread them out on my bed and look at each one more closely. And I'd always wonder where that button came from. What's its story? Button collecting was recognized as an organized hobby through the founding of the National Button Society about 80 years ago, and Wisconsin society is nearly that old. What questions do you have about collecting buttons? Have you ever been to a button show? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Shireen Martin is a longtime member of the Wisconsin State Button Society, which is holding a free public event in Madison, opens today, runs into the weekend. Shireen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
So you've been collecting buttons since the 90s. How did you get started? How did you get interested?
Well, I got interested the way you just said. My mother and my mother-in-law gave me their button. They had button tins. Mm-hmm. But this was in the 90s, probably the mid-90s, and I just got interested in them. And then I found out that there was a Madison Button Club, which is very active, and a Wisconsin State Button Society. And I thought about it for about a year, but then I joined, and I'm very happy. So I've really been collecting since about the late 90s.
So what kind of buttons were in your mother's and your mother-in-law's jars?
Well, in retrospect, they were very common buttons, but you never know. I mean, find your family's grandmother's, aunt's, mother's button jars. I've known so many families that have just thrown them away, and they have uses. But they were interesting, but they were fairly common. But once you go to a button show and see the range of buttons that are there, it really opens up your eyes.
What are some of your favorites?
Well, my favorite is one of my favorites for a material is Bakelite, which is one of the early plastics that was developed, and it was used a lot during the war because it was so sturdy.
And World War One.
World War II.
World War II. Yeah, I just want to make sure what time frame
and
we're in.
So
here.
Okay. There are a lot of Bakelite buttons, and there are other Bakelite radios. But so that's one of my favorites. And then,
what color are these buttons?
They can be any color, normally except blue. They come in a wide range of colors, and I have a huge collection of them. But then there's a lot of glass buttons. I have I brought along some black glass that are, and the top of them are molded to look like thread or fabric. And that's a whole, but then you can also collect by subject matter. I have snakes, roosters, cats, anything you want to.
You have the Zodiac.
Yes, and I have Zodiac buttons. Right, I have a Russian papier-mâché set from the Zodiac.
So do the buttons you collect have pins on the back?
They have what are called shanks, and those are, it's a little, not all of them, some of them have a shank, a metal thing that you sew through. Or you can have a sew-through button, which is one we're familiar with little holes in it, like your shirt buttons.
Yep, that we see
today. That you sew through. And then the older ones, the really old ones, have what's called a padback, which is just a bunch of fabric. and these were made in a lot of them a cottage industry, and those were sewn through the pad on the back, and those were very old buttons.
Where do you find new buttons for your collection? Where do you go?
Well, we go to button shows like the one that's going to be held today, tomorrow, and Saturday. We have button vendors that come. When you go to the button show, you go in and there's vendors that have different – that have tables. And all of the buttons will be mounted on cards that are about 9.5 by 11. And they're – most of them are – if you tell the vendor you're looking for black glass, you're looking for roosters, you're looking for cats, they can show you them. And it's interesting to not even buy anything, but just to go and look and see the range. And they're not, I mean, obviously you can spend a lot of money if you want to, for like French Revolution buttons, but a lot of them are not expensive at all. I have a large collection of black and cream plastic buttons that look very nice together. And they, you know, these buttons are not expensive, but they look very nice together.
We're talking with Shireen Martin. It's our guide to button collecting, longtime member of the Wisconsin State Button Society. What questions do you have about collecting buttons? What do you want to know about the Wisconsin State Button Society? And how would you judge a button collection? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Shireen, when I look at your shirt, your buttons are so ordinary today.
That's right.
Nothing out of the ordinary.
No.
Some white buttons. And I'm wondering, do you look at clothing differently? I mean, the first thing that must pop out at you is the buttons, right?
Well, yes. And most of the interesting buttons, or a lot of them, are on designer clothes. And so, if you're looking at designer clothes, they do use a lot of, and buttons are still being made today. At the National Button Society, there's a gentleman from Italy that comes over with Italian designer buttons. And a lot of the previous designers used buttons. So mostly the clothing, especially now that I'm retired, look for are pretty ordinary. And also people, you know, if you have a very expensive button, you have to be careful washing it and cleaning if you're going to use it on clothing. Although some of them are made to be used by knitters and quilters. But so ordinary clothing, though, doesn't have real interesting buttons, but they're out there if you want to go toward designer clothing. And then there are some, like your jeans, some of the clothing, they have a manufacturer's name on them. And there are people that collect just manufacturers' names on metal buttons, things like that.
You mentioned the French Revolution earlier. Mm-hmm. What do we know about historical buttons and what stories they tell?
Well, a lot of buttons were say, the French, early in the 18th century, 17th century, men's clothes had a lot of buttons on them, and a lot of them were not used to close the clothing. They were used as decorations along the side, and if you look at pictures, they're made out of gold, silver, gems. The Victorian Albert Museum in England has a wonderful collection of buttons, and also in the 18th century, early part of the late part of the last century, women's clothes showed off the woman's waist, and they would have tiny buttons all the way down that would emphasize the woman's figure.
Yeah.
And buttons were used also a lot on shoes, and even children's shoes. So you had to, they're real small, you had to have a button hook, like a crochet hook, to close them. And I can't imagine getting a child dressed in the morning with shoes that have a lot of buttons on them. But normally, if you were at that class, you had a lot of servants to help you.
Oh, we've come a long way with Velcro,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Let's go to the phones now with Mona joining us from Madison. Hi, Mona.
Hi, thanks. I'm not really a button collector. My grandma had a button box, which I still have, but like she said, it's just ordinary buttons, like the extra ones you get on the clothes and, you know, mm-hmm. things like that.
Sure.
But it's interesting, it's fun to look at, so I kept it. But I was wondering if your guest has ever been to the Werther Gallery in Ohio. Werther was a carver and a knife maker, but his wife has a little cottage out back of his museum that's full of her button collections. And what she's done is she's made incredible artwork, big artwork, and hung them on the walls. And it's just amazing to look at, not just the collection, but then her artistry with arranging them.
Mm, so there's art out of the buttons.
Oh, yes,
as well.
Especially, and this is a good use for the everyday common ones that are white, or you can get them in colors, but they're not real collectibles. But they put together, they can make beautiful art. You're right. I haven't been there, but several members of the Madison Button Club have been.
So you joined the Wisconsin State Button Society in 1999.
Right, and the Madison Button Club also.
And the Madison Button Club. What does membership involve? Are there regular meetings? What's the camaraderie like?
Oh, it's wonderful. Madison has a wonderful button club. We meet every month, and we have an educational program every month. So people bring, there's one speaker who's taken control, and people bring whatever they have in that line. It can be rooster buttons. It can be a certain type of material. And then, we do have a lot of fun. And we talk about the shows that are coming up. When people travel, if they find buttons, my husband and I were just in France for our 50th wedding anniversary. And it just happened. There was an international button show while we were there. I told my husband, this is a sign. It was meant to be.
So, you just encountered, you had yes. No idea.
No. And
it
was advertised in the National Button Bulletin. So I went to a French button show, which was much smaller than the ones in the United States, but was very interesting.
What kind of buttons did they have there in France?
They have a lot of metal buttons. One thing, they did not have a lot of Bakelite or plastics. And that tends to be true of Europe. They have, because of their history, they have a lot of metal buttons. And in the United States, we used plastics more, and they're around.
Yeah, we got really into plastics.
They were helpful, and they're inexpensive, a lot of them. And they're very colorful, and they're easy to collect.
Have you snipped off buttons from old clothes that you no longer wear? We're exploring button collections with a longtime member of the Wisconsin State Button Society. Shireen Martin is here. How did you start collecting buttons? Did you attend a trade show or inherit a jar of buttons from your mother, your grandmother, your great-grandmother? What's that story? Where do you keep it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the preservation of clothing buttons here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Button Society now has more than 3,000 members on 4 continents. Its national convention is set for the first full week of August in Portland, Oregon. Maybe you're going to it. And the Wisconsin State Button Society is holding its show this weekend. It starts today in Madison, free, open to the public. Have you ever been to a button show? What kind of buttons do you remember seeing? And how would you judge a great button collection? What would you prioritize? Is it the diversity of pieces or the types of materials? Join in at 800-642-1234. Shireen Martin stays with us, and she is a longtime member of the Wisconsin State Button Society. Let's go to the phones now with Carol joining us from Menominee Falls. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm fascinated by your guest. I didn't even know there was a button show. I grew up on a farm in Iowa, a large family, and my mom had several mason jars, all sorts of jars filled with buttons, and we would collect buttons by clothes that we would just cut off the buttons so we outgrew our clothes. And then up from the clothes, we would cut them up and make quilts. But all the buttons I remember playing with these buttons, me and my sisters, of sorting them by color, by shape, by the number of holes in them, you know, making columns, making piles, and then trading buttons, just like making games with the buttons. And then with my kids, I have three children, so when they were growing up, I did the same thing with them, that they played with buttons when they were, you know, appropriate age, so they wouldn't put them in their mouth. And they just automatically did the same whole sorting and arranging and making piles in different shapes. And then I still have all these buttons. And when I have three grandchildren right now, and when they get older, I plan to do the same thing. Like, let's play with buttons.
I love the tradition there.
That's great. And it gets people interested. Like you say, you should probably be over 3 years old so you don't pop them in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, and it teaches children about size, about shape, about color.
And how to sort.
And yes, and then you keep the button so they have a family history. That's great.
And it sounds like passing it down from one generation to the next. You're making a point of that, Carol.
Yeah, I have such good... It makes you feel so good. It's so weird. But even how they feel, buttons all feel different.
Because
they do.
Of their shape. So, anyway, that's my story. And it just makes me happy hearing about all this.
Thanks.
I thought I was the only one. Well, secret. Now my secret is out.
Yeah. There you go. Well, let's bring in Robert now from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
So what do you know about buttons?
Well, the Mississippi River here has a huge, huge history of clamming here on the Mississippi River. And a guy by the name of Beppels, Mr. Beppels Button, in the 1890s was producing buttons out of horn, bone, and wood in Germany. He was sent shells from the Mississippi River, and he turned those into buttons. He knew that he had just manufactured the most beautiful button that had ever been made. He would sell his factory in Germany, and he moved to Muscatine, Iowa. He started to manufacture buttons that caught on up and down the Mississippi River. All of the towns in Wisconsin had a presence in the button industry. Muscatine, producing 1.2 billion buttons a year.
Wow.
This history of the Mississippi River is being lost. Clamming is now gone. The zebra mussel came here. Clamming is all gone. Mm-hmm. The pearl buttons are still out there. Very collectible. And I feel the finest button on planet Earth. You know, if you'd like to see them and hear about its history, I run a tour boat in Marquette, Iowa, crossing Prairie du Chien, and I do these tours every day, one of the last working tour boats on the Mississippi River, and I talk of the history of clamming, the button industry, and it's a history that's unbelievable.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for bringing that history to us, and what a history our connection here to buttons.
Definitely. It was an enormous industry along the Mississippi. I'm glad you called, Robert, because there's a museum in Muscatine, Iowa that talks about the clamming industry. It was incredible, and a lot of the buttons that were produced were of the ordinary type because they could punch them out of the shells. But there also are beautiful carved pearl buttons and different types. So, yes, it was a huge industry for Wisconsin and for other states along the Mississippi with the clams.
So the show this weekend, there is a judging component. There are some small cash prizes. How do you judge what makes a great collection?
It depends on people enter what are called awards, which are written by clubs or individual people. For example, one for next year is 20 buttons specialized to rabbits or turtles and tortoises. And if you have a subject like this, first of all, the judges would look for you don't have more than 20 buttons on your card, that you have a representation of rabbits and turtles. Mm-hmm. And then also, what are the materials? When you have a subject matter like that, they want to look at as many materials as possible and as many different sizes as possible within that category. And then also, what kind of decorations do they have on the buttons? Can it be paste, jewels, or different things? So those are some of the things that they look for. But then others are just on one material. And then they would look for as many different sizes and decorations on that one material.
Looking for the uniquenesses.
Yes, right.
I shouldn't be asking this question, but how many buttons do you have
well,
in your collection?
My husband and son think too many, but actually my collection is fairly small compared to some other members of my club, but I probably have 2,000, let's say, something like that. But buttons are small, although once you get them framed and up on the wall, they can take up a lot of room. My husband's here, and he's laughing in the background, and I have a son, too. And
how do you display your buttons?
There's actually a whole industry behind showing buttons. And so there are cards that are a specific size, specialized to 9.5 by 11. And then there are shadow box frames you could buy. And you put these cards in them, the back pulls off. You can change regular frames, put molding on them so they're the buttons are away from the glass, but and you only want to mount them with something like telephone wire so it doesn't rust. Don't use pipe cleaners or a type of wire that would rust on the back of them to mount them.
Good to know. Yeah. So can people at the show bring their own buttons to try to learn about their history at all?
They can, yes. People can bring their buttons, and we'll people at the registration desk, when you come in, you'll be greeted, and we like to have people sign in so that we know how many people we have every day. And then we'll send you to one of the vendors, and depending on how much time they have, they can, but they can definitely give you an overview of your buttons. And then if you want to, Madison has several button vendors. If they want to spend more time with you, they can arrange that outside of the button show.
How do you keep your society growing and young, because you're retired, and I'm sure there are a number of retirees who are in the society.
Oh, yeah.
How do you keep this interest going?
Well, and that's a problem for coin collectors, stamp collectors, button collectors, all of that. And we do have some younger members in the Madison Club, but you're right. We also have one of our members just died recently, and she was 100 years old. So it is an issue not only for buttons, but for other things. And one of the ways is to get kids interested early. We do have a junior category in the National Button Society where juniors can join, and they have games, and they get little prizes for different kinds of competitions. But getting kids to see buttons, because most people do not go to a button show. And there are kids that are very interested in buttons. And, you know, they may not collect now, but at least they know what it is, and it's in their blood. And then after they're done with soccer and college and everything, they come back to it.
Soccer and college. Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Shireen Martin is a longtime member of the Wisconsin State Button Society. We have a link, by the way, to the Wisconsin State Button Society events that get underway today at WPR.org on the morning show page. Just ahead, we discuss the first debate of the Democratic presidential candidates. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show here on the Ideas Network.